This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of Shewerman's kyphosis from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Shewerman's kyphosis is a rigid form of spinal kyphosis caused by anterior wedging of greater than 5 degrees across 3 consecutive vertebrae, most commonly in the thoracic spine. Diagnosis is made with standard and hyperextension lateral radiographs of the thoracic spine. Treatment can be observation or surgical management depending on the severity of kyphosis, presence of neurological deficits, and or persistent and progressive pain. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, the incidence of Shewerman's kyphosis is between 0.4% to 8.3%. Keep in mind that this is the most common type of structural kyphosis in adolescents. The typical age of onset is from 10 to 12 years of age, with a small subset having adult onset. As far as demographics, the male-to-female ratio is between 2 to 1 and 7 to 1. As far as anatomic location, Shewerman's kyphosis is usually seen in the thoracic spine, and less common forms occur in the thoracolumbar/lumbar region, which we'll talk more about in a moment. Moving on to etiology, the exact pathophysiology is unknown, but there are several theories, which include osteonecrosis of the anterior apophyseal ring, herniation of disc material leading to loss of anterior disc height, relative osteoporosis leading to compression deformities, and altered biomechanics leading to anterior wedging and subsequent growth arrest. The most widely accepted theory suggests that the kyphosis and vertebral wedging are caused by a developmental error in collagen aggregation, which results in an abnormal end plate. As far as genetics, the autosomal dominant inheritance pattern is now accepted for Shewerman's kyphosis. Associated orthopedic manifestations with Shewerman's kyphosis includes lumbar hyperlordosis, spondylolysis in the lumbar region in 33% of patients, scoliosis in 33% of patients, dural cysts, and compensatory tightness of the anterior shoulder, hamstrings, and iliopsoas muscles. Non-orthopedic manifestations include pulmonary issues in curves exceeding 100 degrees. Moving on to the classification of Shewerman's kyphosis, this condition is divided into thoracic Shewerman's kyphosis and thoracolumbar/lumbar Shewerman's kyphosis. Thoracic Shewerman's kyphosis is the most common form. The curve is from T12 to T12L1 with the apex between T6 to T8. Keep in mind that thoracic Shewerman's kyphosis has a better prognosis. Thoracolumbar/lumbar Shewerman's kyphosis is far less common. The curve will be from T45 to L23 with the apex near the thoracolumbar junction. This is associated with increased back pain. These patients are more likely to be progressive and symptomatic, and there are more irregular end plates noted on radiographs and less vertebral body wedging. Moving on to presentation, patients with Shewerman's kyphosis may complain of thoracic or lumbar pain, and they will likely also have cosmetic concerns. On physical exam, patients may have increased kyphosis, which has a sharper angulation when bending forwards. Keep in mind that normal thoracic kyphosis is between 20 degrees and 45 degrees. Patients may have a compensatory hyperlordosis of the cervical and or lumbar spine. Patients may also have tight hamstrings, iliopsoas, and anterior shoulder musculature. Neurological deficits are rare, but these patients need a full examination. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP and a lateral of the spine. Findings include anterior wedging across 3 consecutive vertebrae greater than 5 degrees, disc narrowing, end plate irregularities, Schmorl's nodes, which is secondary to herniation of a disc into vertebral end plates, scoliosis, compensatory hyperlordosis, spondylolysis on dedicated lumbar films if the patient has low back pain, and finally, you can determine the sagittal balance by dropping a C7 plumb line. You may also obtain a hyperextension lateral radiograph, that is a supine lateral radiograph with the patient lying in hyperextension over a bolster. This can help differentiate from postural kyphosis. Keep in mind that Shewerman's kyphosis is usually relatively inflexible on a bending radiograph. A CT scan is usually not needed. An MRI is controversial as to whether it is indicated prior to surgery to look for associated disc herniations, epidural cysts, spinal cord abnormalities, and spinal stenosis. An MRI may show vertebral wedging, dehydrated discs, and Schmorl's nodes, which again are secondary to herniation of a disc into the vertebral end plate. Keep in mind that any neurological symptom or deficit does warrant evaluation with an MRI. Moving on to treatment of Shewerman's kyphosis, this can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes stretching, observation, and physical therapy. This is indicated when kyphosis is less than 60 degrees and the patient is asymptomatic or with mild symptoms. Most patients fall into this group and can be treated with observation alone. Modalities include physical therapy, which includes postural improvement exercises and back extensor strengthening, core muscle strengthening for patients with spondylolysis. However, keep in mind that physical therapy may have limited effectiveness in the setting of Shuerman's kyphosis. Another non-operative modality is bracing with an extension-type orthosis, such as a Jewett-type brace with a high chest pad. This can be indicated for kyphosis between 60 to 80 degrees, and keep in mind that this option is most effective in those with growth remaining. As far as outcomes, patient compliance is often an issue. Keep in mind that this is most favorable in curves less than 65 degrees, and you may find correction of greater than 15 degrees in a brace. It's important to point out that bracing usually does not lead to correction, but can stop progression. Operative options include posterior spinal fusion plus or minus osteotomy plus or minus anterior release. Indications include kyphosis greater than 75 degrees, neurologic deficit, spinal cord compression, and severe pain in adults. As far as techniques, the ones to know include a Smith-Peterson osteotomy, anterior release, and fusion. A Smith-Peterson osteotomy is best for long, sweeping global kyphosis. A Smith-Peterson osteotomy in the setting of Shuerman's kyphosis will give you less than the typical 10 degrees sagittal plane correction per level, given the rigidity. An anterior release is a technique of the past and is rarely done now due to pedicle screw constructs. Finally, in terms of fusion, dual rod instrumentation is usually performed. As far as outcomes, studies show 60 to 90% improvement of pain with surgery with no correlation with the amount of correction. Studies suggest residual curves of greater than 75 degrees lead to worse functional outcomes. Now, let's talk about posterior spinal fusion with dual rod instrumentation plus or minus anterior release and inner body fusion in a bit more detail. The approach will be a posterior midline approach to the thoracic spine. In terms of arthrodesis, the current recommendation is to include the entire kyphotic Cobb angle and stop distally to include the first stable sagittal vertebra. Keep in mind that the first vertebra is bisected by the posterior sacrovertical line. Previously, this option was stopped distally at the first lordotic disc, but had a high incidence of distal junctional kyphosis. In terms of fixation technique, it is usually a combination of pedicle screws and hooks. Keep in mind that intracanal hooks may be dangerous at the apex of the curve as they can potentially compress the spinal cord. It's also important to point out that you do not always have to instrument at the apex. In terms of correction techniques, you can use a cantilever technique, which is usually two rods placed in the top anchors, then brought down to the bottom pedicle screws. Another option is compression across the posterior anchors. The posterior spine shortening technique of Ponte is indicated in stiff curves where correction is needed. This is done by removing the spinous processes at the apex, ligamentum flavum, and performing a facet joint resection. The goal is to obtain a correction to a final kyphosis of 40 to 50 degrees. In situ bending is usually difficult to do and not helpful. As far as anterior release and fusion, thoracoscopic anterior discectomy may help avoid morbidity of thoracotomy, but is usually not needed. Finally, in terms of neuromonitoring, motor and sensory evoked potentials must be monitored intraoperatively. Surgical complications to mention include neurological complications, distal junctional kyphosis, proximal junctional kyphosis, pseudoarthrosis, hardware failure, loss of correction, and superior mesenteric artery syndrome. So starting with neurologic complications, this has a reported rate of 0.6 to 0.8%. This is higher than idiopathic scoliosis corrective surgeries. This is typically due to spinal cord stretching / lengthening. Therefore, you need to ensure there is enough posterior column shortening. Remember that neuromonitoring changes warrants a reversal of correction. The overall incidence of complications does not differ between anterior/posterior versus posterior alone procedures. Moving on to distal junctional kyphosis, this occurs in 20 to 30% of patients. This is avoided by making proper selection of fusion levels and be sure to use the first stable sagittal vertebra. Also remember to avoid overcorrection, as correction should not exceed 50% of the original curve. In terms of proximal junctional kyphosis, this is typically secondary to overcorrection and negative sagittal balance. This is less common than distal junctional kyphosis. Finally, in terms of superior mesenteric artery syndrome, this is a rare complication. Now, let's end this review session talking about the prognosis of Shuerman's kyphosis. Patients with Shuerman's kyphosis may have back pain in adults that very rarely limits daily activities, that is for mild curves with a mean of 71 degrees. Curves greater than 75 degrees are likely to cause severe thoracic pain. Studies suggest that there is at least some progression in 80% of patients, but not often to severe deformity. Finally, remember that long-standing compensatory lumbar hyperlordosis may lead to lumbar spondylolysis. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. A 13-year-old boy is brought to your office because his mother is concerned about his poor posture. A lateral radiograph shows thoracic kyphosis of 38 degrees. This likely represents, and the choices are 1, normal range of thoracic kyphosis, 2, adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, 3, Schuerman's kyphosis, 4, pathologic scoliosis, and 5, congenital scoliosis. The correct answer to this question is 1, normal range of thoracic kyphosis. So the accepted range of normal T5 to T12 kyphosis is 20 to 50 degrees. Any degree of kyphosis at the thoracolumbar area should be considered abnormal. Many adolescents will present with postural kyphosis secondary to slouching shoulders and poor posture, and thus will have normal radiographs. The review article by Tribus discusses that the indications for surgical treatment include progression of the kyphotic deformity, pain, neurologic compromise, and cosmesis. Moving on to the next question. Examination of a 13-year-old boy with asymptomatic poor posture reveals increased thoracic kyphosis that is fairly rigid and accentuates during forward bending. The neurologic examination is normal. Spinal radiographs showed 10 degrees of scoliosis at Risser stage 2, and there is no evidence of spondylolisthesis. A standing lateral view of the thoracic spine shows multiple contiguous vertebral wedging and end plate irregularities. The kyphosis corrects to 50 degrees. Management should consist of, and the choices are 1, electrical stimulation, 2, a Charleston bending brace at night, 3, an extension type spinal orthosis, 4, posterior spinal fusion with instrumentation, and 5, anterior spinal release and posterior spinal instrumentation. The correct answer to this question is 3, an extension type spinal orthosis. So the radiograph described showed excessive thoracic kyphosis, and remember that normal is between 20 to 50 degrees, and the radiograph had multiple contiguous vertebral wedging and end plate irregularities, all consistent with the diagnosis of Schuerman's kyphosis. The patient is skeletally immature, therefore there is the potential for progression of the kyphotic deformity. Extension bracing has shown efficacy in the treatment of Schuerman's kyphosis that measures 50 degrees to 74 degrees and has actually reduced the curvature permanently in some patients. A thoracolumbosacral orthosis may be used if the apex of kyphosis is at T7 or lower. Indications for surgical treatment are controversial, but spinal fusion most likely should not be considered for a painless kyphosis measuring less than 75 degrees. And moving on to the final question. A 17-year-old girl with a history of Schuerman's kyphosis has a fixed thoracic deformity of 80 degrees. There was no correction of her deformity on supine hyperextension radiographs. What is the most appropriate treatment? And the choices are 1, posterior arthrodesis, 2, anterior interbody arthrodesis, 3, Smith-Peterson osteotomies with posterior arthrodesis, 4, vertebral column resection with posterior arthrodesis, and 5, pedicle subtraction osteotomy with posterior arthrodesis. The correct answer to this question is 3, Smith-Peterson osteotomies with posterior arthrodesis. So the Smith-Peterson osteotomy is most appropriate for long, sweeping, global kyphosis such as Schuerman's kyphosis. It can achieve approximately 10 degrees of correction in the sagittal plane at each spinal level at which it is performed. The pedicle subtraction osteotomy is the preferred osteotomy for patients with ankylosing spondylitis who have a sagittal plane imbalance. It can achieve approximately 30 degrees to 40 degrees of correction in the sagittal plane at each spinal level at which it is performed. Vertebral column resections are extensive procedures, thus they are most appropriately applied to pathologies with sharp angular kyphosis, anterior fusions, and when maximal visualization and decompression of the spinal cord is required. Sagittal curves were reduced an average of 50 degrees with the lumbosacral deformity treated via vertebral column resection. Anterior arthrodesis alone will not provide sufficient correction and stabilization of the deformity. Posterior arthrodesis alone, while providing stabilization, will not correct the fixed deformity. That's all for this review about Schuerman's kyphosis. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.